This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we're sponsored by Bedox Timeline 3D, our good friends at Bedox. Timeline 3D is an app for iOS and for Mac that helps you make amazing timelines. It's available in the iOS App Store and the Mac App Store. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. Bradley, big week.
Very big week.
Yes.
It's like,
shall we just get into it?
Yeah, I just didn't even sit. I just sat around on Monday and watched it. I felt like it was kind of like work, so it was.
Yeah, you can. If it was money, you could expense it.
Yeah. True. So yeah, what's the first thing on the docket?
Well, let me do one quick piece of follow up first. We were talking last week or two weeks ago about Casper. And we did a bit more work with Casper, and we got an email back from one of the folks that work at Jamf. Just to clarify, we had a debate, and I wasn't very sure about exactly what platforms you can install Casper on. Turns out the list is OS X Server from 10.6 to 10.8, Ubuntu 10.04 LTS, 12.04 LTS, Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6, and Windows Server 2008 R2. So pretty comprehensive list of things that you could put your Casper server on if you want to. And yeah, make it flexible. I believe you can also do it on Amazon EC2. I've seen a couple of blog posts about that. You can obviously bring up those Ubuntu versions, and Windows for that matter, on EC2. And if you're using it as an MDM, you could just host it out there. So,
well, that would be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So let's put that to one side. Plenty of meat to talk about this week. WWDC. What did you think?
I was impressed. I think we've all seen around the internet the energy was pretty high, and I thought the presentation was incredible. I mean, from a actual product standpoint, it was incredible, but also just the style of the presentation was Apple at its best.
Yeah, they were really strutting their stuff, weren't they? I mean, you sort of felt it. I don't know what you thought, but when Tim Cook first came out, he just had that look on his face of like a guy who had just won something. It's like, I've just quietened down the US Congress, you know, John McCain's eating out my hand, and now I'm about to show you everything I've got. So he seemed pretty happy with himself, and I think rightly so.
Well, I was really, read an article a few minutes ago from MG Siegler over at TechCrunch, and he was talking about really the last advice that Tim Cook said that Steve Jobs gave him was, don't ask what I would do, do what is right. And he said that Jobs wouldn't have fired Forstall, but Cook did, and it was right. And I thought that was true. I mean, this is Cook's Apple at this point. This, you know, that things are different. This is, I mean, obviously we could be wrong, but it seems to me nothing in iOS 7 was ever seen by Steve Jobs.
That certainly seems to be the feeling that we've got from it. Yeah. And I think it's interesting because I felt last year and a bit this year that, you know, Android has been very successful. iOS has been very, very successful. I was thinking, have we already come to the end of all the new things we can do in mobile operating systems? You know, because I think a lot of that was informed by iOS 6 having been such a conservative release compared to what we've seen now. And I was kind of wondering, is that the revolution over? And I think some of the stuff they're doing in iOS 7 says, no, there's definitely more to come.
People often said that it's possible that Apple's software design will get quite better with Steve Jobs not as the CEO. And I think, you know, a lot of us would tend to agree with that. I mean, I didn't like the skeuomorphic look of Game Center or Calendar. I like what I've seen better. And for all of Steve's brilliance in hardware design, you do often question some of his software design decisions.
Yeah, I think it was one of these things where, you know, the idea of the software was phenomenal and visionary. You know, I'm thinking of things like iDVD and iMovie at the time, and of course iTunes. Like, to have that vision for what you do, but sometimes the details didn't necessarily live up to the grandness of the vision, if you like. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, there's a lot of really nice details in iOS 7. The question is, do they have that grand vision? And I think in some respects with iOS 7, I'm still wondering about that. Because if you think about the show we did a couple of weeks back where I talked about the idea of the power user features in iOS 7. Yes, some of the things I said are actually in iOS 7, but a lot of them are not. And, you know, once you look past the new appearance, which is phenomenal, and I'm not, you know, degrading how much work it is to do that, because it is a phenomenal amount of work, but it's still iOS more or less as we conceived it in iOS 6 and previous, in terms of the app model, the security model, the siloing model, the, you know, and some of those things that I was hoping they would start to break down and open up a bit. They really haven't done anything about that in this release, at least that we know of so far from the keynote. So we'll see. Great attention to detail. Not so wholly sold on the idea of their grander vision, but maybe, you know, it feels like a reboot. I don't know if that's how you feel about it, but it kind of feels like the first Daniel Craig James Bond movie, you know, going back to the start or something and making it anew.
Well, in regards to some of the things that we wanted we didn't get, it's quite possible they just didn't make the cut because either they were too big in scale or they just didn't have time. And, you know, it's one of those things we probably had to either choose a redesign of the interface or data sharing.
Yeah, you know, nobody at The Verge is going to write about, oh, iOS opens up the sandbox, you know. But they would write whether or not Apple could bring up a new UI.
So I'm very, very happy with everything I saw. I think from a personal user of Apple products, thrilled. And, you know, as an administrator of an Apple school, thrilled with what I've seen. I'm very excited about iOS 7. Of course, I would love for it to be out by the time school starts, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, iOS 7 wasn't the only thing at the keynote, and we should probably dig into iOS 7 in some depth later on in the show, but we also had an upgrade to the MacBook Air. Big change in Wi-Fi, Bradley. Something I'm sure you're interested in.
Yeah, of course. I've just got a new MacBook Air, so that would make sense that new ones would come.
Naturally.
But we've got the first Mac with 802.11 AC. It's interesting that, you know, of course, we've got the new AirPort Extremes with AC. Now, it's important to remember that the spec isn't final. But, yeah. I mean, of course, we had this with 802.11n. There were draft devices. And then if there was a big change from the current draft to the final spec, I'm sure it's, you know, you can do a firmware upgrade to fix it.
Yeah.
So the new AirPort Extremes are a 3-stream device. So, and on 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz. But the new MacBook Airs are only 2 streams. And, of course, iOS or iPhone and the iPad are only single stream. So I just find that kind of interesting. The Retina MacBook Airs, the MacBook Pros, and really the MacBook Pros for many years have been 3 streams. So it's kind of interesting. I had some Twitter discussion this morning, and it's probably really just, you know, from a power standpoint, couldn't do it because the Broadcom chips that are in the Airs support 3-stream, but there's only 2 antennas.
Right.
So, it's important to remember that AC is 5 gigahertz only, and 5 gigahertz generally does not penetrate walls as well. It's 2.4. And since it's simultaneous, if you are, you know, roaming farther away from the AP than, you know, you'd like, it's quite possible that you'll be back on 2.4 gigahertz and 802.11n.
So you can drop back down to that.
Yeah, and of course, the reason that iOS is a single-stream device is really about battery. Even, I think HTC has an 802.11ac phone out that's still a single-stream. And I just don't know, like, if you could fit 3 streams in there, and even if it didn't suck the battery life, I just don't know that you would be able to tell a difference, you know, day-to-day right now.
Isn't there something also, and I'm going to embarrass myself with my lack of RF engineering knowledge here, but don't you have to have the antennas a certain distance away from each other that you can't necessarily do in smaller devices?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good possibility.
I've heard that at a presentation somewhere. I forget where it was, but I've also heard that as an explanation for why most mobile devices are single stream is because they can't separate the antennas in the physical case enough to get any benefit.
Yeah, and
somebody can write in and tell us the actual answer to that question.
I'll take better battery life over an extra antenna.
Yeah, I would say so. Yep. So, MacBook Airs, yep. Other thing to say about MacBook Airs from a kind of school point of view is that the entry-level model looks like a lot better deal now than it was before because they doubled the storage.
Yeah, isn't it 128 now?
128 in the entry-level model. and all the 13-inch models dropped $100 as well. So that they're sort of edging closer and closer again to where they need to be for entry-level laptops in schools. But I think ever since the MacBook went away, it's been a little bit difficult. I mean, I know you've got a whole stack of MacBook Airs in just this summer, Bradley, but I've heard a lot of schools say that they're not crazy about the MacBook Air and they want something, I don't know if it's psychological or if it's true, but they want something that looks more rugged. Whether or not the MacBook actually is more rugged or not, I'm not that sure.
But yeah, I mean, I would argue that it's more durable just because of the flash memory versus the spinning disk. But yeah, 64 gigs was certainly low. I mean, pretty much anybody will fill that up pretty quick. And 128 is a nice way to start. It's interesting that like as you upgrade, like if you max out an Air, it's the same price it was before. So it's only like kind of like the entry level price that got cut.
Yeah.
But and a big upgrade. Important. I mean, it's the all day battery is great. That'll be big for schools. And it just looks like not a modest upgrade, but it's just one of those like keep plugging at this machine. Let's keep driving it forward. And my quote unquote old Air is a beast, and I run VMware pretty much all day. It runs great with only 8 gigs of RAM. Of course, the new ones still top out at 8 gigs, which I know some people would love to see that at 16 gigs. But it's still, I mean, it's just one of those machines. It's I would argue that the MacBook Air is nearly the perfect laptop for the majority of people.
I have to agree with that. I mean, I've had this 13-inch since January and have not hankered for another computer since. I mean, I pulled out I've got a 27-inch iMac here as well, which I used to use, hard drive-based, Core i7, the whole bit. It feels incredibly slow compared to this MacBook Air, and far beyond just the spec differences in the machines, and it's all about SSD. It really is. It's huge. What about the Mac Pro?
It's interesting and daring. I mean, I won't buy one. I think what I am most intrigued about is the kind of storage it's using.
The SSDs on the PCI?
Yeah, it's just, they're just changing the game again. It looks like a beast. I mean, I won't buy one, but if you're one of those people that needs one, it really looks like they've been working hard about it. And in the typical Apple way, people have been talking for years, is the Mac Pro dead? Is the Mac Pro dead? Which I'm sure the people at Cupertino were wanting to scream, no, we're hard at work. I'm not sleeping because we're working on it. But it looks like Darth Vader in a way. But, it looks like a great machine and very powerful.
I could not believe the size of it. When they put it up on that slide beside the Mac Pro, and it was, like a third of the height of the front panel. Unbelievable.
I don't even want to see the repair manual. And it, you know what? It may be very easy to repair. Because the old Mac Pros where, just everything's kind of slid in and out, and maybe they're doing that. Maybe they have ways where you can replace parts easily and things like that because, again, of the nature of the person using that is typically a very, very, heavy professional user. And when I say professional, I don't mean like a business person. I mean like a video editor, somebody that like just chiming on this thing all day long. Maybe it's easy to repair. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe like if one thing dies, maybe you're dead. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems to me that once you take the sort of cylindrical sleeve off, you've got fairly free access to most of the parts of the machine. So we'll see how that goes. What I want to know is how much is that thing going to cost?
I think
it's going to be quite shocking how expensive it is.
Because I think a lot of people, when the pros were in like the $2,000, $2,500 range, the people that thought they wanted a pro for the reasons the pro didn't exist, maybe they didn't need necessarily the power, but they wanted all the drive bays and things like that. That's not who this computer's really aimed at. That computer, if you're wanting power without the Mac Pro price, is probably the iMac. So I don't know that they are going to please all the people that want the Mac Pros, but I think they're going to please all the people that need a Mac Pro.
I think that's a really good way to put it. I mean, it seems to me that it's a Mac Pro in the sense that people who do work on that machine, that machine is making back money for them every hour that it's turned on. And it's not just for people who just happen to have a really big Aperture library. And by really big, you're talking a few hundred gigs. It's for people who really need to get a job done in a time frame.
Well, it's kind of like if you have a farm you have a tractor for a specific purpose.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, you don't take that. People don't buy tractors to drive up and down the road. That's just not what they're made to do. And I look at this computer that way. You know, this computer is aimed at the video editor. It's aimed at people who, you're right, that's a good way to put it, is this machine is making them money every hour.
It's a truck.
Yes, yes. The 4K
it's
resolution.
The first truck, yes.
The 4K resolution support, very interesting, considering Apple does not yet have a monitor that supports that. But
And they were very clear to say that. They said third-party 4K displays.
They could very well be working on one, and by the time this thing ships, they may have plans to have it out, but they're kind of setting themselves up so they don't have to have it out.
Exactly. Yeah, they're very careful in that, on the expectations game there.
I think one of the things they could add, and John Syracuse was talking about this and it made a great point, is they would be smart to build their own Thunderbolt enclosure because people would buy it.
Yep. For sure. Thunderbolt things are expensive.
They're not cheap, but my gosh, they are fast. I think I've mentioned this on a previous show of doing Migration Assistant. I had two machines that are production machines here, and we kind of wanted to swap them. Like, one was an Air doing something that I needed a Pro for, and then the Pro was doing something that the Air could do easily. And so I kind of did, you know, swapped, you know, copied the Air's data via Time Machine to the an external drive, then I wiped the Air, then put the Pro in target disk mode and just connected them via Thunderbolt and did a migration assistant, and it was done in minutes. You know, it used to be that was like, you know, an hour and a half, because it was quite a bit of data it was trying to
move.
That
was your afternoon. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like literally like you start it, you go like get a cup of coffee, you come back, and it's like at the setup screen. So did I click that? When did I click that? It's really a beast. I would love to see kind of like some not USB key sticks. That doesn't make sense. But like a small Thunderbolt drive, like you just plug into a computer. That'd be
Thunderbolt
great.
Thunderbolt thumb drive. Yeah, Joe, I'm really intensely aware that like the performance of computing that I personally experience has sort of plateaued, because I think that what I've done over the past sort of 3 or 4 years is I've traded off increased performance in my computers for convenience and mobility. So, you know, four or 5 years ago, I had like a Mac Pro, you know, and all kinds of stuff on my desk. And now I've got an iPad and a 13-inch MacBook Air, which are by no means as powerful as some of the computers I've had in the past. And they're certainly nothing like as powerful as the kind of computers you can buy today. But they are incredibly convenient, lightweight, small, cheap, and long-lasting in battery life. Sometimes you're kind of shocked when you look around and you say, well, you know, all computers can actually do that. But in fact, the kind of stuff I have on my desk now is a tier below what used to be the top level of possible performance. Because for years and years, I kind of tracked that leading edge, because everybody saw increased benefits in their performance at that time. But today, you know, every laptop, like you said, the MacBook Air is a perfect laptop for most people. People just don't know what to do with the computing power that's available to them there.
Well, and so much of what we do has really changed, I guess, day to day on the computer. I mean, we're at the point where if like pretty much every laptop Apple sells can run iMovie and do okay with it. I mean, it's not going to, maybe it'll take a little longer to encode, but there's just not that much that average user is doing day to day. That you're going to max out the power of a Mac. I mean, of course, the way we want to see improvements is, you know, maybe a 2-day battery or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's just, and maybe this is just me getting older, but I'm finding myself like not tinkering as much, not needing to, I guess, have the latest and greatest in terms of my computer. That just like what I have works great, gets the job done, and it gets the job done in a really ample time. And, you know, maybe,
yeah.
I don't know if it's signed, just you're right, that computers have really gotten so fast and our needs have plateaued. I mean, we're not, you know, our home videos that we might be editing aren't 4K yet.
Yeah, I think also that people have become more sophisticated buyers of computers. And I think for a number of years, people were buying computers based on their most extreme outer edge use case. Right, so it's like, what if I want to play this game, or what if I want to burn a DVD, or what if I want to do something with a camcorder that I don't own yet? And they're buying computers just to sort of defend themselves against any possible outcome. Well, today, of course, like you said, many more of those things are actually within the capabilities of any computer you're going to buy. But I think people are also recognizing, well, I'm never going to do that on a computer. We've kind of, a lot of people have been through one cycle of buying a really good computer and then not using most of it, and now they realize that they can get away with much lower specs, relatively speaking, and still be perfectly fine with what they want to do.
Well, and it's just kind of interesting that really, even like maybe back in 2004, when people were buying laptops, because that's, I guess, when I remember the shift away from desktops to laptops really happened, that people were wanting desktop replacements. So they wanted these big Alienware laptops that were 17 inches and that were like had these dedicated video cards. And then people like slowly just wanted things to be smaller and smaller and lighter and lighter and lighter. And they're willing to trade power trade power for battery and power for thinness.
Yeah, I think everybody just got fed up with carrying such heavy things around. 12-inch PowerBook G4, I think, was the beginning of that.
That was my very first Mac.
Really?
I should have kept it, but I sold it and really made good money on it. I mean, I sold it for $300 4 years after I had it, and I mean, that's like craziness in you think of like PC days. But that was such a great computer.
If you had kept it for about another 4 years, you could have probably doubled your money again, because they became kind of collector's items for a while, didn't they?
I got it when I had an eMachines laptop, and I sold it and got a 12-inch PowerBook. It came with Panther, and I remember I bought Tiger. Came out pretty quick after that. I think it was like $170 to buy Tiger. And, of course, I bought it. I mean, it's just crazy thinking back to those days. I bought, and I had to get it in the mail. And they mailed me a big – it wasn't even, like, in a small box. It was in, like, a big box. You remember those big PC game boxes?
Yeah,
$170. And I actually think I was – now, I was still in college at the time, so maybe I got a discount. I think I maybe got it for $120 or something. But, yeah, they sent me a box in the mail. And then it was just like, you think back to those days and...
like a caveman.
Yeah, it's like, think back to, it's like, you tell your kids, like, son, I had to buy a disc and it came in the mail and it was in a box. And it's like, okay, Dad.
And we enjoyed that at the time.
Oh, it was great. I mean, you were waiting for the UPS guy to show up. I mean, that's why if 3D printing ever comes out and you just, like, print your new iPhone at home, like, that's kind of sad because, you know, we're tracking the UPS guy. Like, you know, where are you at? I mean, when the iPhone 5 came out, like, I used to live near my office, and so it was the same UPS guy. Like, I stopped him. Hey, man, you have my new phones on your truck. Can I get those? And he got them for me. Like, you know, those are memories.
It's gone too far when you have a sort of personal relationship with your delivery drivers.
Too much from Amazon. too much from Amazon. It's bad because then our UPS driver changed, and I don't like our new one because they come too late in the day.
Yeah, he's doing more. He's doing a bigger area now.
Yeah,
cutbacks. But anyway, that's Tiger, right? And here we are at Mavericks, right? 10.9.
Well, lots changed.
What do you think of the name?
It's fine. I mean, I'm not one to care so much about that. I think it's neat. I think it's thinking outside of the box, and I think it gives them room to grow. I guess I'm most thankful that John Siracusa, second time mentioned on the show, is not stopping his big reviews, because I love those. I think they're absolutely a gem to read. So if he's not stopping, because he had talked about stopping at the end of the cat names, then I'm fine.
Yeah. I got to say, I'm a fan of the whole thing. I like the name. I'm kind of a sucker for all kinds of Americana, so it was going to work for me regardless of where they chose. I mean, they could have chosen South San Francisco or something, and I would have still thought it was awesome. But it's an interesting release of OS X. I thought that it seemed quite conservative, but also quite power usery. I don't know if you get that sense of it, you know. And I don't know if that kind of speaks to, well, you know, the casual users have all fled for iOS already, and it's only the geeks are left in OS X, so we might as well turn it up for them. You know, a big whole thing about multi-displays and things like that, which is not really a feature that consumers ever use, I don't think, really. You know, they seem to have done a really nice job of bringing the Lion era full screen mode into a world that actually has multiple screens again.
Well, because as you're right, people that are using that, probably a great portion of them, people that use multiple displays, you know, probably would love to do full screen. I mean, I would love to do full screen. I've got a big 23-inch Samsung LED sitting next to me right now that I have Evernote open in, and I've always wanted to use full screen mode, but you can't. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not even like it's a big feature, but it's just like one of those things that It's kind of like a sigh of relief, like, finally we got that. Like, that's huge.
Yeah, because in Lion and Mountain Lion, it wasn't just that full screen mode with double monitors was inconvenient or something. It was just completely broken. I mean, it was like a non-feature. You know, you plug in another display, forget it with full screen mode. So this looks like they've really got it together pretty nicely.
Well, and this is really, I think, the evidence that this platform, not that desktop computing has plateaued, but no. It's matured, and it's, you know, to me, looking back at, like, Leopard, that was, like, one of the last big kind of, like, throw a thousand features at you that are all consumer-facing. Like, you know, Time Machine was one of those features that was just, you know,
yeah,
that everyone should use this. But now they've got all that stuff going, and they can just kind of hone in. And you know, maybe the multi-display stuff, full screen, like, you know, it's hard to put that on a box necessarily, but mm-hmm. the people that use that, it's huge. And so they can kind of spend some time kind of honing in on these little things and kind of chipping away. And it's kind of like if you're building a like a wood model of something, and you have that tree, and you kind of get the basic shape of it. And so mm-hmm. maybe Leopard was that basic shape. And then Snow Leopard, Lion, Mountain Lion, and Mavericks, this is like really going for the detail.
Yeah, I certainly got a sense of that as well, you know. And it was very... it was things that people have been talking about for a long time, you know, things like tagging and tabs in the Finder, you know. I mean, those are 5 and 6 year old feature requests in some cases, probably longer as far as I know. And now they're here, you know, so we kind of get that stuff. I thought a lot of the focus on battery life was really interesting, and it seemed to be another step towards just the realization and the reality that almost all Macs that are sold now are battery powered. As well as all the mobile devices they sell for iOS as well. So it seems to me that that's, you know, all the things, all the discipline things and the safety things, if you like, that are in iOS to stop developers running away with your battery life, and all the discipline that iOS developers have to put into their programming to make that work well for the users, I think more and more that's going to come, let's say, back to the Mac in terms of battery use, radio conservation, all of those kind of things, and it's going to just be all the better for that. I suspect that's where they get a good chunk of the bump for some of those new MacBook Airs.
People have often said that battery technology really hasn't advanced with our computing power, and I mean, I guess you could say that's true because we still don't have necessarily cars that run off batteries for, you know, long periods of time and are, you know, cheap. So, you know, if you can't necessarily fit a bigger battery in there or fit a higher capacity battery because it doesn't exist, like, how do you do it? Well, you make things use less power. I mean, that's, yeah. It's like, you know, you got a problem that you can't solve. Okay, let's go fix it another way. Let's make it where, I mean, the demo they showed where they, you know, something was, I think it was like, you know, streaming on the screen when they, you know, put something else in front of it, the power just dropped way down. And that was beautiful. And those are those details that consumers won't notice, but yeah, they will appreciate when their battery lasts all day.
Absolutely. Definitely. iBooks for OS 10. Oh, hang on. Wait. Step back. We forgot to say one thing. Using an Apple TV as a spanning external display for a Mac. Did you catch that?
I did. That was beautiful.
Pretty cool.
Again, a detail. I mean, this is just going back to me. This is the Apple mantra. They do things in a way that make complete sense when they do them. And, you know, I would have loved to have had that like 2 years ago or a year ago. But when they do it, they do it right.
I'm going to be very curious to see, and I may organize to test this at some point. Is it possible to connect your computer to an Apple TV wirelessly and then close the lid and use the flat screen television and a keyboard and mouse as your Mac? I don't know if that could be done because it's not a physical connection to the display, but we'll test that at some point and see.
I've never been one to want to use my laptop with the lid closed. Don't know why.
Really?
Yeah.
No. Well, I do it a lot, and I think part of the reason why I do it a lot is because I do have some bigger displays and I have a very small laptop, and I think the disparity between the two sizes is kind of maddening to my brain. But also because of that multi-window full screen issue, I like to use full screen. So I prefer to use one screen rather than two, whether that be the bigger one only or the smaller one only, but not both together because of that. So yeah, iBooks for iOS... start again. iBooks for OS X.
You know, again, going back to, I would have loved to have seen that last year, and it makes perfect sense. You know, selfishly, because I have an iBook author book, I'm glad that those seem to be available. And then multiple books at the same time is great if you're doing research.
Yeah. And I think that's a big one, is having multiple books open at the same time is going to kind of take it up a good notch. Also, it will make it a lot easier to test books. You know, people who are iBooks author is quite good at, you know, being faithful to the layout that you see in the authoring tool. But if you're doing straightforward EPUBs, it's not quite so easy to, you know, do the round trip testing of that on a device. So for those people, that's going to be a really big deal, just being able to load up that book right on the Mac and look at it in the same rendering engine that it is on the device as well. I see you put a question in the notes here. What is it going to cost?
Well, I mean, because the natural, if we think it's going down every year, it was, you know, because what was it? It was 29, then it was 19. So you would think this would be 9, but maybe it stays at 19. I mean, even at 19, it's a bargain. Of course, I've often really wondered why iOS updates are free and why OS 10 costs money. And I know some people have said that it's because the way the revenue for iOS is booked, it's booked on a subscription revenue. They book it over 2 years, and then at the Mac, they realize that revenue all at once, so they can't give you something without charging you. But I'm just wondering, like, could they not change it where they, you know, bring the Mac out over, you know, 2 years? I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know.
I mean, I'm not an accountant, but I'm certainly not an American accountant either. But I think it doesn't seem to me that there's an inherent reason why you can do that for one product line and not for another. It's just a matter of making that change or deciding to make that change at some point. But I think it was something that Tim Cook made a big deal about, and Apple as a whole have continued to make a big deal about for several, months and years now, that the upgrade rate of people to iOS versions is massive. You know, he made a big song and dance about, 93% or something being on iOS 6. And it's nothing like that for the Mac. And I think the transition from Snow Leopard to Lion stalled that dramatically. It used to be that the whole Mac user base would move over to the newest version fairly sharpish. And I think that has stopped in its tracks. And I know many, many more people now who are still running Snow Leopard and Lion, because there were some fairly sharp cutoffs in terms of the hardware that would run Lion and then the hardware that would run Mountain Lion. And I think the Mac has started to suffer from a little bit of fragmentation on that score. And I think, and the reasons for that were not money, right? That's not the problem. The problem was, you know, dropping off hardware support, I think, in large part. But taking the money out of the way would be another good way to get people back up to speed on moving forward and a lot of that stuff. Okay. I have a thing here about Maverick Server, about which we know almost nothing, and about which almost nothing was said at the keynote, except that if you go onto the Maverick's preview page on Apple.com and scroll down to the bottom, there is basically one paragraph about Maverick Server, and it says two things that are really, really interesting for our audience and for us as well. And the first one, and I think the most important one, is a thing called Caching Server 2, which, it says on the site, it will cache, it will speed up the download of App Store, Mac App Store, and iTunes content, and it will cache them there for iOS devices and for Macs, so that if you have 100 or 1,000 iOS devices all downloading an update to GarageBand at 600 megs each, your external network will only see one download, and then your caching server will distribute that to everybody internally, and that's huge. People have wanted that for so long. I'm crazy excited about that, and I'm going to run an OS 10 server forever now just so I can have that.
I'm wondering how that works. Do those devices have to be bound to that server, or is it just like it kind of intercepts those traps? I'm just wondering how, like, you know, let's say, for example, a hotel wanted to do that. Like, they said, well, we're sick of all this traffic from the App Store. Let's just put an OS 10 server. And does it just automatically, like, sense what's there and starts caching it? I don't know. It'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, I don't think those details are public. But it is interesting that the name of this is different. This isn't Software Update Server 3, because software update server has been an OS X server for years, which will cache the Apple updates that used to come down through software update before it was integrated into the Mac App Store. This has got a different name in that sense, and I think it is a different set of functionality. Software update server has got a lot of power in terms of administrators can hold back certain updates. They can pause them, force them, things like that. And caching server doesn't say anything about that, and it's not described as a replacement for that. It just seems to be this is a thing for caching. It's like a sort of edge cache for the App Store. Be interesting to see how they handle security for that, because if you think about it, you're caching a binary from the Mac App Store or from the App Store. You can't be caching. It must have some signing capability there, if you think about it, because, you know, if you've got 100 people with 100 different Apple IDs all downloading from the store, and then you switch over to them all downloading from your local cache, then you must have some kind of unsigned binary version from the App Store. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because their
caching server must be able to sign it on the fly. Must be some callback or something to the store, because you know, it just wouldn't work otherwise. There must be some signing capability on that server, so it'll be an interesting challenge to keep that secure. I'm always thinking of ways to subvert things. I'm a bad person.
Well, that's just well. I think if you don't, I mean, it's always good to play devil's advocate.
Yeah, it certainly is. There's also some mention of Profile Manager having some additional features. It doesn't say what they are. It just says it makes it easier to manage devices and content. I don't know what that means. I haven't tried that yet, but I haven't used Profile Manager in a couple of years. It came out in Line, I think. I tried it then. I haven't used it since. It's quite a different MDM to other ones. I don't know if you've tried it, Bradley?
Briefly.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because most of the MDMs that we've talked about in previous shows are all about configuring a device, right? So this device gets these things. Whereas Profile Manager is a wee bit more kind of, this person gets these things regardless of however many devices they have connected. So for example, you go into Profile Manager and say, this person has an email address, and, you know, push them a mail profile and stuff. And however many devices that person enrolls, they get those pushes. So it's kind of a slightly different, a change in emphasis to other MDM servers. But I haven't tried the new one yet either. And even if I had, I couldn't tell you what it was about. So,
yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure it'll be Apple App Store purchase as well.
Yeah, just an add-on. So, back into iOS 7.
Yeah, let's. Right. If you don't care, let's go ahead and take a quick sponsor break.
Let's do that.
Move into iOS 7. I want to thank the guys at BDocs Timeline 3D, BEEDOCS.com. for sponsoring the show for really all of this year, off and on. They make a great app for the Mac and for the iPhone and for the iPad called Timeline 3D. The one we're talking about here is Timeline 3D for iOS. It's a dead simple app for building multimedia timelines on iPhone and iPad. Universal app, one price. It's really, really inexpensive. The price shifts around, you know, from week to week, so definitely check it out for whatever the current price is. It's in the App Store under Timeline 3D. One of the examples that they've used is that a classroom of students in France worked to build a multimedia timeline of major events in World War II. So students added images, video clips, and then also had narrations that they recorded themselves actually on the device. So again, it's kind of a one-stop shop for building these things. Timelines are 2D when they start, and then you can hit a button and change it over to a 3D flyover effect. It's incredible when using AirPlay, either to an Apple TV or if you hook up a projector as well. So it's really the simplest way to make multimedia timelines on iOS. Great ratings in the App Store. That's really, you know, don't take our word for it. Read other people. David Sparks, our friend over at MacSparky.com, said, "It looks like magic and makes me look brilliant." A couple of the other reviews said, "It's a must-have for trainers, teachers, speakers, and lecturers." Somebody else said, "This app has helped me clarify and communicate crucial evidence. It is a godsend for me." So, again, great app. Timeline 3D for iOS. Check out their website, bdocs.com, BEEDOCS.com. Thanks for sponsoring this episode of Out of School.
Yes, indeed. So, iOS 7. I think my first reaction to it was to be very impressed. Surprised, I guess, at the visual appearance of the home screen. I think the home screen is the bit that is most shocking, if you like. And I guess I kind of feel like there's a tension between the icon styles that they've done and what the apps look like once you're in. And I think the actual appearance of the apps seems a lot more mature than what you see on the icons. The icons look, to be honest, a little bit cartoony and a little bit kind of in need of some refinement. But I think the apps themselves look really, really clean and fresh and new and very solid as well. So I'm pretty excited about it, to be honest. What do you think?
I like the design. Yeah, the icons, you know, they were fine to me. Again, I'm not necessarily a designer, so I don't, you know, I'm reading, you know, arguments, people arguing back and forth of why they like them and why they don't. But I think the thing to remember here is this is beta 1, and I would venture to bet by the time this thing, you know, hits, it'll be, things will look differently, because you think about it. I mean, this is they had 7 months to do this.
Yeah.
And So I love the new UI. I think it's a breath of fresh air. I actually switched to using Twitterific for a little while today on iOS because it kind of has that same style, and I'm thrilled with it.
Yeah, I've always kind of liked. It's almost, if in the apps, it almost feels kind of Swiss, if that makes any sense. That kind of lightness and clarity. You know, it's very kind of Swiss design, German design, kind of Dieter Rams Braun style. And some of the apps, you know, in particular the Compass and the Calculator apps, look like direct homage to some of that design work in the 70s and early 80s. So I think it's going to be fine. You know, there's some tweaks. There are some things that maybe can get polished up, and I'm sure they will. But I think this design can last a good while. It may not last forever, but it seems a lot more timeless than some of the other stuff that we've seen in iOS 6 and below. And some of that was right for its time as well, but I think I'm really pleased with it. And the big question to me actually is not whether Apple can execute on this, but whether other designers in other companies can execute on this. And I mean, if you think about it, for about 3 years now, Apple hasn't led design on iOS. You know, people have gone off in so many different directions. They've branched off here, there, and everywhere, and apps like Evernote 5 and many, many others where they sort of layer their own UI design and decisions on top of iOS. You know, in some senses, iOS was just the default apps in the home screen. And then when you get into any other app, it's something very different. I think that people are going to have to pull back from that a bit. And I think users are going to demand things that look a lot more like they're at home on iOS rather than your sort of Tapbot style or your Evernote style of, you know, here is our UI skin for our app. I know I'm certainly going to want for those productivity apps, and I'm going to want to see the ones that look a lot more like iOS. Good question as to whether they will actually, you know, whether people will A, do it from a branding point of view, and also be able to actually achieve the same kind of design clarity in their apps. But there are some brilliant app designers out there, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it's... And even if, you know, even if, let's say, nothing changes from beta 1 in terms of from a design perspective, you know, the icons and whatnot from beta 1 until the final, this is kind of the iOS for, I mean, to me, this is, you know, iOS 6 and below was OS 9. And this is setting us up for the next 6-7 years.
Yeah, it very much feels like a reboot. And it's not technically, the APIs are broadly similar. Of course, there's enhancements, but in terms of, the way that we use these devices, because I think one of the things as well, Bradley, is that if you think about back in 2005 and 6 when they were working on iOS 1.0, I'm sure the people at Apple, and also as we didn't, have any idea just how much stuff we would do and how complex and how deep the things that we would do in these devices went, and they are now. And I think this is an interface that can really hold up for some of those more complex tasks in the future. Where was the iPad in the keynote?
Interesting. Yeah, maybe they're still working on it. If you think about it, you think back to OS or iOS 3, I mean, the iPad in some ways always felt like it was the iPhone blown up, and some of the UI elements, like the way, you know, look at Notification Center. I mean, it's like a quarter of the screen. Not even that. It's maybe it's, you know, yeah, 25, a quarter of the screen. So
yeah.
I think there's some work that could be done there to make better use of the interface. Like a good example, and this is not even an Apple app, but the Nest app for the iPad, it makes terrible use of the bigger screen. Like it just like kind of blows everything up. Not like in the 2X mode, like for the iPhone apps, but just like they're not doing everything they could with the amount of room they have. So I think maybe they're tweaking that, and maybe just from a software standpoint, it wasn't ready.
Yeah, I think it does speak to a lot of that, you know. And this is what made me suggest on Twitter that iOS looks like it was a long way from shipping, because if you can't even show one thing happening on an iPad, or even just to say, look, here's this new design, here's how we reinterpret this new design for the bigger screen. If you don't even have that to show, I'm kind of like, well, that, you know, how far away are we from actually having this in our hands? And I guess time will tell when the new beta seeds come out for iPad as well. I mean, let's face it, the iPad is not going away. It's not being put in the back burner, and I'm sure iOS will ship for both devices at the same time. But it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that from the beta process as well. So, to actual features. To me, Bradley, the biggest one by a country mile for our purposes is AirDrop in iOS. I think that's going to be enormous.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you think about it, you finish a Pages document, instead of trying to do the email, it's like, you know, teacher walk by, okay, turn in your assignment. It's huge.
Yeah. Yep. And it's teacher to teacher, it's student to student, student to teacher, and it can happen anywhere as well, because it's not dependent on your infrastructure.
Right. It's using Wi-Fi, but it's using kind of peer-to-peer. So the same way AirDrop works on the Mac, which if you've never used it, it actually works pretty well.
It works really well, yeah.
I mean,
go ahead.
As I lay you, a lot of times we use Dropbox and things like that for it, but like if you're in a place where you don't have, you know, either not on the same Wi-Fi connection or you don't have Wi-Fi, it works great. It's fast. Yeah.
I think it was one of these things that I know with some people I've had to help at school, they hadn't sort of conceptualized how AirDrop worked. They thought it was just like file sharing. So I had one example where a teacher came, and this is on the Mac, not on iOS, obviously, but a teacher came through to my office and she said, look, can you go into AirDrop and I'll AirDrop a thing to you from my classroom? And I was like, well, you're going to have to bring your computer through as well, because it was based on us being nearby, not just being on the same network somewhere, because her classroom's at the other end of the school from mine. So I think it's going to be useful in a lot of educational situations. You know, you take your kids on an iPad school trip somewhere, you're not all on a Wi-Fi network, but you want to share things that you've made or you've captured. Classrooms. You know, there's some schools still don't have Wi-Fi as well. So that, to me, is the absolute headline feature in iOS 7 for education, is AirDrop. But a little bit of regret for those people who bought iPad 2, because AirDrop is not on iPad 2. And this is a hardware thing, isn't it?
Yes.
It's got to be in the chipset, right?
Yes.
Because the range of devices that AirDrop supports is quite narrow. It's basically just fourth generation iPad only, not even third generation. iPad mini, iPhone 5, and fifth generation iPod Touch with the 4-inch screen. And that's the only four devices that support AirDrop. I mean, it's fine. There's a reason for that, right? It's not just Apple wants you to buy a new iPad, so they're screwing you over. It's those previous devices just don't have the stuff in the chip they need to make AirDrop work. So, yeah. That's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, I can't wait to play with that. Of course, I'm not running the beta, but even if I was, like, I wouldn't know anybody really. I don't know anybody else is running it, so
yeah,
it wouldn't matter.
You need
a
friend.
Of course, I can't upgrade my iPad either, because there's not a beta scene. But I want to test. It's like with the old app Bump. Like you install, oh, this is great, I can bump stuff. You didn't know anybody that had the app, so you couldn't, didn't you?
Yeah, that was very true. You'd install it like one day when you met somebody who had Bump, and then it would sit there in your folder of things you never use for years. There were not that many other changes, I would say, in terms of like big power user features in iOS 7. I mean, Control Center is nice in terms of being able to swipe up and make some changes, but there were no changes, as far as we know from the keynote, to the ability to round-trip documents into other applications, for example. There's nothing about changing the default apps on the system. And some of the photos changes were nice, but I don't think there's any sort of fundamental change to the way that you manage photos coming off these devices, really, is there, Bradley?
No, I mean, if you're the type of person that's got a, 25 gig and up photo library, I mean, you still need a Mac to manage your photos. It's not, yeah. I was looking for something more like EverPix for Apple to do something like that, where it's like everything's in the cloud. I mean, you take it on your iPhone, it's immediately on your Mac, and it's there forever. If you organize it on your phone, the changes all show up everywhere. I don't understand how iPhoto on iOS and the Photos app on more. I don't understand that relationship. So it's like edit photos in one place, and how do you get them back to the Mac? And it's really kind of complicated. And that's why I wrote a review of EverPix, I guess, last week. And to me, that's what EverPix solves. Like, it just handles it, and it's everywhere. Like, I don't have photos locally synced on any of my devices. I just open EverPix, and there are all my photos. It's kind of like iTunes Match for photos, and that's really all I'm wanting. And I realize that that's a lot of space to handle, but, seem to do it for music, I guess, but I know with music they don't have to keep lot of individual copies. But
so let's keep our fingers crossed for iOS 8.
Yes, yeah, so pretty getting my wish list.
Yeah. So let's start the wish list today for iOS 8. But there's still a number of good features in iOS 7 that are quite interesting from our point of view. A lot of these things that we're going to talk about are things that we don't have a lot of detail on because. The sessions are under non-disclosure. We haven't really watched many of them yet. There were some slides that came up, as often do in these keynotes, where it's like, a big picture in the middle, and then there's, 25 different named things in small text behind it. Like, oh, there's too many things to mention, but here are some more. And everybody takes a furious picture of that so they can analyze it later to see what was said. But I think some of the things that were on those slides were very interesting from our point of view, Bradley. And the number one that popped out to me was a thing that they called managed app configuration, which I don't really know what that means, but my guess as to what it means is there still is a feature on macOS 10 server and has been for many years where you can deliver to a Mac app a pre-configured bundle of basically preferences. So instead of starting with the app's default preferences, the app will start with preferences that you specify. And my guess is that this is the same thing for iOS, where you could, through MDM, push out a bundle to an app that you've got installed, a third-party app as well. It wasn't just Apple apps. You could potentially push that over MDM and give your users settings that they need to have, whether on or off from the default state. Which I think could be pretty useful. For example, if you're trying to configure pages and you don't want the users to have to make the decision that comes up at the start of pages as to whether they should use iCloud or not, you want to put one setting in there for them, then you could just push something out there and that would work. So that's my guess for what that is. I can think of a good few ways that we would use that.
Yeah, just anytime you can streamline, I guess, things from an end user perspective, not necessarily looking for control, but just looking to preempt questions that will come up, like, what do I do here?
Yeah, the way it was done in macOS 10 server was very interesting because you could say, I want to manage this preference never, which meant you just got the default, or I want to manage it one time, which means you would set a setting, the user would see it, but the user could change it to whatever value they wanted after the fact. And then there was an always setting where, regardless of what the user changed that preference to, OS X would always change it back to whatever the administrator set. And I don't know. I may not even be right as to what that feature is, but that's my guess as to what that is. And the analog is there from OS X as well. What else did they have? MDM streamlining. That's all it says is streamlining. So I don't know exactly what that means, but. I always thought MDM enrollment was fairly streamlined as it was, but I don't know if you just kind of get blinded to the number of buttons you're clicking when you do it 5-10 times a day to test things.
Yeah, you do really almost want to talk to somebody that's like works at a big company and like that's their job. It's like they're just like the mobile device deployment person and like and say, okay, this is what you're doing now, and then once we find out what the streamlining does, like say, is this better? Like, is how does this work? And if their eyes light up because they even though it's a small thing, but when you do something like that a ton of times, it can make it easier. So yeah, and of course this is just one of those things that every version of iOS, really since iOS 4, has opened up more and more APIs for MDM providers, and so it's just really something you can always expect.
Yeah, I think to even reach back further than iOS 4, I think from even iOS 1, it seems to me that there's somebody at Apple, and I don't know who it is, that their job is just to go around big companies and big universities and ask them, why are you not buying your products? And then they write down all the reasons they say, and they go back to Apple and they say, well, these are the reasons these people say, and they just count them all up like votes. And then year on year on year, they just take away more and more reasons for people not to buy these devices. You know, and in iOS 2, it was like exchange support, and then iOS 3, it was device security was a big thing. And then iOS 4 was whatever else it was, and 5 and 6, and 6 was like supervision and additional controls, for example. And now things like the MDM has become a big thing in the way that you manage iOS devices, which it wasn't 3 years ago or 4 years ago. It's really one of the default toolkits now, I guess, in big, big deployments. And it seems to me that Apple's just been knocking down these cars one by one by one, and whatever MDM streamlining actually means, I think it means something great for people who are putting out 50,000 at a time rather than people who are putting out 100 like me. We shall wait and see.
Yes, we shall.
Yeah. Parent application VPN was another thing that was just mentioned on the back of one of these slides. And I think that one kind of is obvious. It's VPN traffic being routed by the application rather than for the whole device in one go. Which is interesting because it means that if you do run some kind of VPN back to your site, and I think for schools, probably the reason to do that would be mainly to filter web traffic. That is a way that you could perhaps say, well, I only want the Safari content coming back through, but I don't want, if I allow YouTube, for example, I don't want to have to pay the bandwidth costs for everybody's YouTube at home in the evenings as well. That's a kind of enterprisey thing, though. I don't know if it's necessarily something that a lot of schools are necessarily going to run.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Yep. VPN is good if you need it. If you don't need it, well, VPN is great for kidding onto Netflix that you live in America. Let me just put it that way. Moving on. Next thing I liked, multi-author photo stream, which is how photo stream should always have worked in the first place, if you ask me. Do you use many photo streams, Bradley?
I don't. I've got a whole separate kind of workflow for photos with Dropbox and whatnot, but I've got friends that do, and like I got a friend that's a husband and wife, and like they love photo stream, and that's where how they share photos.
His and hers photo streams, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and so like he's been saying, like, this is what I've been wanting. And so when I read that, I think I read an article, somebody talking about that or something. I just like copied and pasted it into an iMessage and said, problem solved, and he was happy.
Yeah. Now this is interesting, potentially interesting in the education scenario as well, where, you know, if the class is working on something or groups are working on something, you could have photo streams where whenever somebody does something, they just photograph it or screenshot it for that matter and stick it in the shared photo stream and everybody else gets it. It could be a really good way to build up a bank of photos for something you're working on. Everybody puts them in, everybody has access to them, and then, you know, that photo stream can maybe go away at the end or whatever. That could be really useful too. One other small thing, I'll just jump ahead in our list here. Support for PDF annotations in Quick Look. I don't know if you've ever run across this problem, Bradley, but I bump into it quite a lot when we deal with forms and so on, is that on iOS 6, if I fill in a PDF form and email it to somebody and they get it in their mail program and they open it up in the Quick Look preview in mail, it looks like there's no content in the form because the Quick Look preview in iOS doesn't support annotations of any kind, even though they're actually there. If you open up in PDF Expert or Acrobat Reader or something, they're not shown in the preview. And apparently that's going to work now, which is great. It'll save a lot of confusion and support calls for me. Where did all my form data go? Well, it's in there. It's just not in there. It's in, if you open it in PDF Expert, you'll see it. So next thing, Control Center. Android people, of course, are saying they've had this for years. Ha ha ha. But looks like a nice implementation of same idea.
And they Sherlocked every flashlight app in the App Store.
Well, not every app, because I have a flashlight app that can post to Facebook. I'm not kidding.
And, well, you look at some of these apps, they're like on version 4. I'm like, I mean, you should have had, like, should have been like, I don't know, maybe every, they just update it once a year for the new OS. And
it's the fourth mobile ad network they've been on.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so, well, one of the flashlight apps I have can actually strobe, which is kind of, it's fun for freaking out the children as you're putting them to bed. But that's not fair to do that. Yeah, so what do we get in Control Center? We get access to the radios, controls for the radios, airplane mode, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, turn on Do Not Disturb as well. I think you can turn that on straight mm-hmm. from there. There's control for the brightness of the display, the music controls, basically all the things that were one swipe to the left from the first multitasking bar have all migrated into Control Center, I think is fair to say. And also control for AirDrop is in there as well. So you can control your visibility to other AirDrop users using Control Center as well. Access to flashlight, access to, I think the second icon is a timer. It's kind of like a clock hand with a backwards arrow on it. I think it's timer. And then a couple of things, calculator and the camera, which is cool. That's always something that's quite good to have as well. So, yeah, I'm glad that's there. I think, you know, especially when you're traveling abroad, you want to keep turning on and off of airplane mode to save data or whatever. It's going to be very useful. Find My iPhone features, new Find My iPhone features. What was that, Bradley? Was that the activation lock thing?
Yeah, the activation lock. And I think that'll be great because I think really most thieves hadn't figured out about how to do that. And I think, you know, it's one of those just like not a low-hanging fruit feature, but it's, again, just like I said earlier, it's a nice detail.
Yeah, there were some suggestions on the web a while back that Apple should implement require a PIN code to shut the device down. And it seems like this is a step even deeper than that, which is to actually have it interfere with the activation system, even so even if you wipe the device rather than shutting it down. It seems like a nice thing to have, and it's interesting that more and more there's going to be more you have to do to get your stuff off a device before you can pass it on, which is fine. You know, you want to make sure it's not something we do every day, so it's something that should and fairly can take a few more steps than normal.
Well, and Apple's even got a support document online. I'll see if I can find it for the show notes. Like, steps to, it's obviously for iOS 6 and below, but like steps to do before you sell your device. And one of them is going in there and turning off iMessage so you make sure it deregisters that device. And, you know, which I think that's Apple is acknowledging, look, our people are selling our devices and they're staying in the ecosystem and we'd prefer to buy them to buy new ones. But hey, you know, it's better than nothing, better than them buying an Android phone. Yeah. So it's like, let's help people to know how to transfer them and to know how to secure their stuff.
Yeah. Yep. It's a nice thing to have. And I think, yeah, the more of this stuff they can make consumer friendly, the better. You know, it's kind of like the two-factor authentication discussion we had a little while back as well. Like, the easier we can make these security things, the more people will turn them on, and the more people turn them on, the better we all are. So, next big thing for us as iOS admins is this question of automatic update of apps, for which John McCain, for one, is absolutely delighted, as far as I can see. Administrators worldwide, not so sure so far, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think most of our listeners would know that we're not this way. And so it's not about like wanting to say, you know, we want to control everything. Is it's, you know, if there's a, I don't know, let's say, let's look at Evernote. And let's say you're in Evernote, an Evernote school, and you were on version 4, and the version 5 rolls out, and you auto update to it, and teachers come in one day, and it's completely different. You haven't done any training on it. And you know, there's some questions there. And of course, you know, you and I were talking before the show started that, you know, with Google Apps, they often, you know, make interface changes, and it just, they kind of happen. And so maybe, you know, I could argue that, like, this is the world we live in and things update, but I also would love to, in some ways, like, be able to control that and say, like, okay, we want automatic updates, but let me kind of either vet them or, like, control when they happen, or just, you know, not necessarily full control, because I'm happy that they will auto-update, but let me kind of control when that happens.
Yeah, because you might not want it happening at some point during the school day. You know, I think it would be quite... Well, here's another point, actually. Let me paint another scenario for you. You're a teacher, you're teaching a class. Halfway through the class, you say to people, go ahead and pull out your iPad and start doing something. And half the class, oh, Miss Pages is updating at the moment, I can't do anything. That's disruptive to your teaching. You know, that instability in there is disruptive. And particularly if you don't have a caching server on hand and say it is a big app, you know, if you use the Elements, let's say, which is a gigabyte, and suddenly iOS just decided to kick off an app update of a 1 gigabyte app that you just about wanted to use 2 minutes ago, that could be a problem, right? So it's not... For most of our apps, most of the time we're not using them, right? But there is an opportunity there to do something very inopportune, let's say, to get the time wrong. So I don't know if app updates are going to be... You know, maybe it is the same thing as iCloud Backup, where it's when the device is locked and powered up, we'll push some updates to some apps. Or if it is just like at any time during the day, you could get an app update. And perhaps they'll control it so it's only on Wi-Fi or something like that. But it'll be interesting to see some technical details on that, just to see, well, you know, have they thought about all of these things, or are there some things that we might want to put in place some more controls for?
And maybe that's something in that in caching server. I mean, we're going off. We've read a paragraph or a sentence about caching server too. So, you know, of course, it's not on our outline, but the new way the apps update in the background, that could be great for us, because one of the things I always hated about, let's say, you know, Keynote or Pages, is they didn't update until you opened them, and then it like downloads all the changes. Well, yeah. you know, that could be great, that, you know, Pages could already have your latest content, that Keynote could already have your latest content, and it's ready to go.
Mm-hmm. These are the changes to multitasking in iOS. Yeah, I think that could be... iCloud document syncing in iWork is going to be a big thing for schools who use that. And I think just as an iOS user, that's one of the things I'm really excited about, because I know that some friends who were using Nexus 7 tablets, they were saying, you know, it's one of the great strengths of Android is that whenever you pick up the device, because those things are running in the background, whenever you pick up a device, it feels responsive. It feels faster because you're not waiting for something to happen every time you open up an app. Of course, the cost of that uncontrolled approach to that is just battery life hits, big hits on battery life. But Apple seems to be doing quite a smart thing where they do it on schedules based on when you use the app, and they also do it opportunistically when the user brings the device on for something else. Right? So I open it up to check my email, and Twitter can get woken up in the background and they can check as well. So there are some good things. And of course, in Evernote, one of the things, I don't know if you've run into this, Bradley, since Evernote shipped the reminders feature, is that if I set a reminder on my Mac, I have to go and open Evernote on my iPad and on my phone to make sure those reminders are in those databases as well. And with this new multitasking thing, that's something that can be a thing in the past.
Yeah, I was actually opening Evernote and like kind of seeing how long it took to sync, and it's like I've made a lot of changes today, and it was, you know, 3 or 4 seconds for it to download all those new notes. And that's, I mean, you add up all that over a day, and that's a lot. And it makes it, and it'll, I think it'll make your iPhone feel faster because your stuff will just be there. Of course, you know, if there's an app you're not using, it's just not gonna, you know, it's not gonna work, and it's not gonna be one of the situations where, you know, you're blaming
you something once and then it was just resident forever.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I think that's like one of those features that, you know, seems in some ways small, but I think it'll go a long way to help our apps feel up to date and fresh. So, you know, OmniFocus is another one. Your database will always be up to date. You won't have that, you know, a couple seconds of syncing and things like that. Of course, your RSS feed, that'll be there as well. So podcasters, of course, you know, our listeners obviously will love that, and me mm-hmm. being a heavy podcast user, I'll love that as well. I mean, I was just kind of looking through my phone, like thinking, what apps here will be useful for that?
The answer is a lot.
Yeah, it really. I mean, my flashlight app will be automatically. nah. Well, again, an app like Sketch that I use really quite frequently, but it's all photos, so it's, you know, a lot of times they're 2 megabits a photo. Mm-hmm. That'll be nice. It's automatically up to date. That'll be good.
Yeah. It feels like there's a lot of things in iOS 7 that are like that, which are just like, yeah, it's all just better. And I think once you get used to using that kind of stuff in iOS 7 and developers build for it, going back to iOS 6 will just feel like a thing out of the arc.
Well, it's one of those things, like, that's a feature that, like, my father-in-law, like, won't notice that day one on his phone. Like, he won't understand that. But, like, over time, I think he'll realize, like, okay, that's already up to date. Like, the, you know, I read USA Today app, it's already up to date when I open it.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right, you won't notice it, because it's one of those things that is kind of niggly on iOS, but nobody complains about it because they can't conceptualize what the feeling is, or the lack of misfeature or whatever in iOS. You know, they don't have even a model in their heads of what the problem is and why that is the way it is and so on. But I think when you use systems like Android, where that isn't necessarily so much of a problem, it would start to be a bit more jarring to you in that. So, last thing we've got on our list here is the range of supported devices for iOS 7, which I was quite surprised was as broad as it was. It's basically everything iOS 6 supported, except iPhone 3GS and its kind of equivalent iPod Touches as well, which is really generous, I thought. You know, I guess devices are getting more powerful, like we said before. You know, they don't have to drop support for these devices if they don't. They don't want to if they don't have to, is what I'm trying to say. And I guess increasingly less often they have to for hardware lack reasons. Obviously, some of these features, AirDrop being the big one, are not coming to every device. But if you have an iPad 2, you're going to get almost all the features of iOS 7, which is awesome. And a lot of schools have got a lot of iPad 2.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, you know, really, I guess it's really just been less than a year since they dropped the 3GS, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, I don't know how that, I mean, I don't know anybody that, if you bought a 3GS last summer, are you really concerned about iOS 6? I don't know.
Yeah, it's, you were living in borrowed time anyway, you know, and I think that's something I've been saying to schools a wee bit about iPad 2 as well, is like, and this is the first thing we've seen where iPad 2 has not been a full citizen on the platform because of its lack of Wi-Fi Direct support in the chips, which is is one feature out of the whole operating system. So let's not overplay that as something that's a harbinger of the death of iPad 2 or whatever. But you're just starting to see iPad 2 edge out of full citizenship on iOS for some features. Not many, but some. And of course, they've got to keep iPad 2 going because the iPad Mini is so similar to it architecturally. But you see there have been some small changes in the iPad Mini, the new Wi-Fi chipset, Bluetooth, the new cameras that are just going to make it a wee bit sharper device than an iPad 2 in a lot of small ways. So yeah, big week. We've talked a lot. Lots to say. Lots more to say as time goes by, I think. And the more we, I guess everything from now till iOS 7 ships is going to be under non-disclosure, so we'll probably not have another iOS 7 show for a while unless some big news breaks publicly that we don't know about privately through the developer connection. But I'm excited. I think it's brought something fresh again. And for sure, Metro from Microsoft did something fresh, but the problem with that is that people don't seem to want to buy it. Not to put too fine a point on it. And iOS being, you know, one of the dominant players in the market for mobile devices is really going to bring a new thing to a lot of people. And because the rate of growth in these devices is so big, the number of devices that can support this is huge compared to all the devices that have been sold. You know, iPad 1 is just a tiny sliver now of all the iPads ever sold. It's almost insignificant. So I think it's going to be really exciting. I think I'm counting the days. I have access to the betas. I have not installed it on my daily phone. I think it's going to be quite a challenge not to do so at some point, but I should really try and be very sensible about it.
I'm going to resist. You know, it's possible that when the iPad one comes out, I might put it on my iPad, but I just, my phone is like day to day is so important to my, what I do. And I certainly am not going to run Mavericks. I can't afford that in the slightest day to day.
No, no. I have a spare iPad that I'm, we'll have an iPad mini that I might try iOS 7 on once the iPad beta has come out. It'll just be interesting to see how some of that stuff works.
Well, it was maybe the reason Apple did that is because they knew a lot of the people who were coming to WWDC brought their iPad to install the beta on, and he said, "Well, sorry, you got to do your phone," I mean, which is a challenge because how many people have multiple phones? I mean, I guess you could do an iPod Touch, but
yeah, I mean, you could certainly do an iPod Touch, I guess, but I really think that was just about. We just haven't finished the iPad version yet, and nothing much else. Interesting, not a whole lot of new features about Apple TV that we heard about in the keynote. I think that seems to be a product that is very much an accessory in the iOS ecosystem. It has not been elevated to sort of full platform device status yet, even though it is architecturally underneath. But interesting to see it getting used more in Mavericks. And I'd be interested to see, you know, can I get a TV, put it on my desk, and sort of integrate that somehow with my Mac workflow. I'm going to be interested to play with that a little bit.
Yeah, I had a perfect Apple TV experience today at lunch. I took a little bit. I came in early this morning, so I took a little bit longer of a lunch. And I went home and got my son, and we were going to go have lunch. And so he was... he was watching Toy Story or something on an iPad. He was just like, you know, was watching it. So I said, "Hey, buddy, you know, let's go." He's like, "Hi, I'm watching Toy Story." I said, "Well, just take it with us in the car." You know, it's just mm-hmm. the place we're going is like literally up the road. So we just took it with us. We left it in the car while we ate, and then he watched it on the way home. Well, it actually died on the way home. It was like, must have been really close to being dead anyway. So it died, and he said, "Daddy, it's off." So I said, "Buddy, you know, it's dead." Of course, he was upset. So as soon as we walked back in the house, I dropped him back off and walked in, plugged it up. I was charging it in the car so it could actually like turn back on. So got it turned back on, walked in the house. Turned the TV on, airplayed it, plugged it in, and said bye to my wife and him, and then left. And it's like that was magic that I could just like walk in with a device, it beams to the television, and it just works. And so the accessory was I think a good point. It is still an accessory for the iOS ecosystem, but hey, it's a great accessory, and I have three of them.
It's a fantastic accessory. I love Apple TV, and I think. We've gotten past the point where it was slightly unreliable at times in its early incarnations. It's now, for us, it's rock solid. Hopefully in the future there will be some enhancements to Bonjour that will make it easier to deploy at a very large scale. But I'm actually visiting my friend Abdul Shohan at ISA Academy down in Bolton at the end of this week, and I believe he's running something like 90 Apple TVs on his network, so people can do it. I'll maybe pick up some tricks from him and update you on how he does it. But I think it's a sleeping giant, I think, and it's already getting a lot bigger. I mean, I don't know people you talk to in education, Bradley, but I know that as soon as you just show them Apple TV, they're like, "We've got to have that. We've got to have that at our iOS deployment."
Well,
it's almost sort of no longer optional. You know, when people see it, they want it so bad.
You know, it goes back to, it's like a case. It's one of the things that's like, okay, you get your iPad, you get your case, you get your Apple TV, you get your car charger. I mean, that's just part of the deal. And if you've already got a television in the room, it's $100.
Yeah. The only one thing I would like to see Apple do is make it easier to get onto VGA.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, I think one of the things that we've found is that... like Apple TV is great conceptually, the whole AirPlay thing is brilliant, we love it, but I'm not ready to pull out every projector in my school and put in a television panel, and that's mainly just because of cost. If I could afford it, I would do it, but I need to replace a projector, I need a very big flat screen television of the type that I cannot afford, and the ones I can afford are just not big enough. So I think if Apple brought out an HDMI to VGA adapter that worked for Apple TV, I think that would be That would be pretty welcome for schools, because at the moment, a lot of people are kind of scrubbing around. The Canix ATV Pro adapter is the one that most people use, and it works great for us. But I think a lot of schools are buying things off the internet, and they don't really work, and they're pretty unsatisfied. And it's not actually Apple TV's fault as much as it's the fault of this adapter they got shipped from China, because they didn't want to spend £45 or whatever it is for the Canix one. So if Apple could make that easier, that would be great, but that's clearly going to be an adapter and not a change to
and Apple TV. I think the challenge there for VGAs, I think, requires like more than just a cable, where I think if they did like a if they did a DVI to HDMI, like if your projector had DVI, that would be much easier. But I think there's, you know, I think there's always something with VGA to HDMI that like is requires something that like has power.
There's some brains in the box as far as I know, and you've got to have the Canix ATV Pro does a really good job, because what it does is it has a short cable and an HDMI plug on one end, and then a box with a VGA socket in the back, and also a 3.5 mini jack, so you can plug into speakers, and it splits the audio and video signals off the HDMI into both of those ports, and it works seamlessly and it works perfectly for us as well. But I have seen other ones which are not anything like as good. You know, the video can be kind of offset to the side, or there's interference or something like that. And those things are a lot cheaper, but they just don't work. And a lot of people have been disappointed with some of those as well. But yes, all hail Apple TV. Apple's television strategy hiding in plain sight.
Yes.
Indeed. Shall we wrap it up there, Bradley? We've talked a long time tonight, but I think it's been such a big week. We couldn't do anything else.
Yeah, it's like one of those fun weeks. It's, you know, it was great. It was a lot of fun to watch. It's good to be in the industry we're in. It's fun to see this technology and not just be for us to play with, but to actually to do stuff with.
Yeah, it's great to put it out in the world. So, let's leave it there. We'll be back next week with more. Don't know what we're going to talk about. We've come to the end of our plans of things we're going to talk about. If there's anything you want to hear us talk about, drop us a note. We have a contact form at outofschool.net. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear from anybody who wants to sponsor the show. And thanks for listening.
All right, have a good week.